building in the heart of Ronville. This is the Ron Van Dam Show on New England Broadcasting. Yowza, yowza, yowza.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show.
Thank you so much.
Hold on tight, things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Hey, welcome to the program. It is indeed the Ron Van Dam Show. I'm one of those people. Thank you. All right. How are you today? Good to see you. What day of the week is this? Quick. No, it's not Sunday. It's Thursday. Okay. Whatever day it is. What do you want from me? Welcome to the show. I have an interesting program for you today. My guest wrote a book about the city of Boston. It's everything you want to know about Boston and some stuff you don't want to know about it. Interesting. It's the area in which I live, by the way, just in case you didn't know. I live in the Boston area, the greater Boston area, or the lesser Boston area. I don't know how to put it. Boston's a fascinating, a world city, yet very expensive. How does it compare to others? What is it about Boston? It keeps popping up all over the place. We'll find out from the author today some of the interesting things that go on. Not everything, but some of it. If it was everything, you wouldn't buy his book, and then this would be pointless. But we'll talk to him momentarily here. I thought in order to leave some time in order to speak to this gentleman, I would read some of your emails. Usually, I would say I would read some of your cards and letters, but that's archaic. People don't send things to people in writing anymore. What are you, crazy? We email everything. That way, it gets there quicker and you save the stamp. That's true. So, I have some emails here that were printed out. Look. See, I still had to print them out because I'm old. If I were younger, I wouldn't print out the emails. I'd simply have a tablet in my face and I would just scroll and read. But I'm not that young anymore, so I actually print them out, which is fine. I'm just telling you what I do. All right, here's some emails from listeners As my background is quite impressive. I'm not talking about my ass. I'm talking about what I've done in my life as far as interviews are concerned. I've probably performed well over 10,000 interviews with all different people, thousands and thousands and thousands of different people and experts in various fields. So my knowledge of things is actually incredible. But my memory of the interviews is not that impressive. So you can learn as much as you want, but if you're going to forget it, then what's the point? Well, at the time, it was fun. So my knowledge of all different subjects is quite extensive. Not to tout and not to brag or anything, but I know more than you do. Do I exercise that knowledge? No. But I do know more than you. Am I better than you? I'm not better than Trump, apparently. He thinks he's the best of everything, so I'm not even going to go there. But otherwise, yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's see. All right. I'm crinkling the paper in order for dramatic effect. Indeed, I don't have to crinkle the paper, but I'm doing that because this is a radio thing, and, it kind of heightens the deal. Okay, let's see. This is from Marcia Henry. She lives in Des Moines, Iowa. Oh, I didn't know there was a Des Moines. Ron, you said you were smart. You didn't know there was a Des Moines? All right. Marcia says, I fell down last week and I don't know, or I haven't gotten up yet. Oh my God, Marcia, call somebody. Why are you emailing me? Call somebody if you have. Oh my God, Marcia. If anybody knows someone named Marcia, you haven't heard from her in about a week, she can't get up. Go to her house or wherever she lives and help her up. Would you do that, please? Thank you. All right, let's see what else we got here. All right, Jonathan Katz. K-A-T-Z, not C-A-T-S. Jonathan would have been in the cast of Cats on Broadway if it was C-A-T-S, but it's not. It's K-A-T-Z. Jonathan says, I'm in construction and I don't want to be in it anymore. What should I do? Change jobs, Jonathan? Okay, there you go. What do we got here? Joseph Marinaro. Hi, Joseph. What does Joseph say here? I've been listening to your show for years now, and I'm wondering what the hell is wrong with you. That's not nice. That's not nice. Yeah, doing something a little special with your email there. See what else we got here. Gonzi, G-O-N-Z-I, Chin, C-H-I-N. What the hell kind of name is that? I am your sister. Oh, my God. Gonzi, I've been looking for you for like 5 decades. Oh, my God, I am your sister, but I don't tell anybody because I listen to your show, and it would be far too embarrassing to admit that. Please give me a call. Here is my phone number. Wait a minute, it's missing 3 digits. What? And here is my email. What? Don't contact me. What? But I am your sister. What? That's cryptic. That is cryptic. Wow. Norman Shoemaker. I live in a trailer park in New Mexico, and I was visited last night by an alien who probed me. Should I tell the authorities or keep it to myself? Oh, my God. I don't know. Why don't you see what happens tonight? You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? All right. Let's see what else we got. My husband and I don't seem to get along. He comes home at 4 o'clock in the morning and claims that his car breaks down every night. He smells like liquor, smells like perfume, yet says there's something wrong with his car. Should I believe him? Wow. Yeah. Of course. Why wouldn't you believe that? You have trust issues? What should I do with the body? Well, okay, what do you mean as far as exercise is concerned? I'm going to do. I put my. What should I do with the body so no one finds out what I did? How deep do you bury the body so the dogs can't smell it anymore? Oh my God! This is not good. I'm not answering this. I am not answering. What should I do? I've lost my left shoe. It was my favorite pair of shoes. What do you suggest I do to locate my other shoe? Wow. Get a life. Get another pair of shoes. Holy crap. And you took time to email? I'm more concerned about the first lady who fell down a week ago and still hasn't gotten up. That's bothering me. get one of those alert system things where you wear it around your neck like a some type of a strange necklace, and if you fall down, you simply press the button and, you know, but change the batteries. Otherwise, that's not going to get you anywhere either. Wow. Well, those are some interesting pieces of stuff. All right, my guest is going to join. Have I wasted enough time? I think I have. We're going to contact our guest. But first, we're going to play this little message and then see what happens as far as that's concerned. Wow, God, I'm not going to do that email thing again. That didn't work out too well.
First, they put jalapenos on your hamburger, but that wasn't hot enough. Then came habaneros, but still, that wasn't hot enough. Next came the ghost pepper, and still, that was not hot enough for you. Well, buckle up, tough guy, because Burger Guy thinks you're not man enough to handle the heat of our new sweet flaming mother of heaven. What the f*** did you assholes do to my hamburger burger? Featuring two of Burger Guy's signature paper-thin patties topped with an experimental hot sauce made from a concentrated hot pepper extract that has only been approved for military use by North Korea. This burger will burn a hole through every inch of your intestines and then slap your mama on its way out for good measure. This burger is so hot they wouldn't let us test it on prisoners. Death row prisoners. But for a limited time, you can try your luck at your local Burger Guy. If you're not a complete pussy.
All purchases of the sweet flaming mother of heaven, what the f*** did you assholes do to my hamburger burger, must be pre-approved by a certified attorney at law with proper notification of next of kin. Sweet flaming mother of heaven, what the f*** did you assholes do to my hamburger burger must not be consumed within 500 yards of schools or within 1,000 yards of open flame. All Burger Guy franchisees reserve the right to ignore cries for mercy or requests for immediate medical attention.
And we're back with Dan Dane, who has written a very, very interesting book, actually compiled one called The History of Boston. And he's a walking duck boat tour is what he is. It's amazing. Dan, education. I mean, I guess when you have high technology business and some of the greatest minds in the world, you also have an educational system, especially on the college level, that is just unparalleled as far as I can see.
Well, and that goes back really early. So the Puritans, so just a little bit of background about how Boston is founded. People know about the Pilgrims who came over in 1620 to Plymouth. And the Pilgrims were not called Pilgrims in the time. That's really a later term. They considered themselves what was called separatists, which is they wanted to separate from the Church of England. The Puritans were related to the separatists, but they wanted to, within the Church of England, purify what they thought of as the excesses of the Church of England. And their dogma, the Puritan dogma, believed that people needed to have an individual relationship with God that they would learn through study of the Scriptures. And so they believed that every individual needed to be able to read so that they could read the Bible and understand, you know, not have sort of a priestly hierarchy that was mediating between individual worshipers and God in their worship. And so what this meant was the Puritans had a great belief in an educational system. And in fact, you know, when the Puritans came and founded Boston in 1630, they required that every new town have both a meeting house, which played the role of both church and sort of place for town meeting, as well as a school. Every town had to have a school. And Boston, of course, is the first American city to found a public school, mm-hmm. Boston Latin. And then 1636, the General Court establishes a college at what was then Newtown, for lack of a more interesting name,
right.
And they get a donation from a man named John Harvard, who was from Cambridge, England, and so they decide after founding the college to name it after their benefactor, mm-hmm. John Harvard, who we know very, very little about, although he donated a library, and and Newtown changes its name to Cambridge based on where he was from. And so Boston becomes a pioneer in education at both the grade school level, you know, all the way up through higher education. Mm-hmm. It becomes a great pioneer in educational reform of the 19th century with people like Horace Mann, and this leads all the way through to the founding of all the great universities in the area. And so question Boston and Cambridge. You know, this the geographic area has the greatest collection of colleges and universities in the world. Yeah. There's no other city that's close, and it's been a major driver of our economy. You look at all the companies that have been founded, you know, just from graduates of MIT. It's extraordinary.
It's interesting that with all the great things, there are some strange and inquisitive things. I guess that every large, successful city, San Francisco, New York City, Boston, etc., almost become too expensive to live in. But I guess I understand why, but that's kind of a conundrum, I suppose.
Well, my book spends a lot of time on this topic because it's of great interest to me as someone who represents real estate developers. And it's, you know, largely it's because we don't let the free market operate to build the type of real estate. You know, how it's not just housing, but, you know, office rents in some places are over $100 a square foot. Hotel rooms are over $500 a night in Boston, and that has real repercussions on what kind of city we are. I mean, the city's unaffordable for people to live, but if it's $500 a night to visit Boston, only the most well-off people can be tourists here. We're limiting who can come to the city, and tourism is a major part of our economy. And so we sort of want to protect what is special about Boston, but we make it extremely difficult to build here. And that's true of the coastal cities where the jobs are. And it's a real problem for the national economy because we have a system set up where it's very difficult for people to move to job-rich locations like the coastal cities, Boston, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles. And instead, we encourage people to live in the lowest-cost areas that are not both not so job-rich, you know, the Sun Belt, Florida, as well as the fact that those are the highest carbon consumption locations because of they're very car dependent and air conditioning dependent. And it's a terrible way of doing land use planning.
It is, but but there's no answer to it. It's a supply and demand kind of thing. I mean, if people are going to pay that price, then they're going to make that available for people who want to pay that price. I suppose that's
That's exactly
is.
How the market works. Yeah. That's right. I mean, the laws of supply and demand apply to the housing market and the office market and the hotel market and industrial market, lab market. But there's a phenomenon called induced demand. So the normal response to a situation where supply is greater than demand, which leads to rising prices, is that when you create supply, normally you think of them as independent, right? If demand is more than supply, you increase the supply and prices moderate. But when you create supply that's attractive, it ends up increasing demand.
Right.
Which is a phenomenon known as induced demand. You see this with highways, that you have a two-lane highway that's full of cars, and you say, well, if we build a third lane, it'll solve our traffic problem. And you build the third lane, and it induces demand. More people end up driving because there's more capacity, and then the highway is just as clogged. So sometimes when you increase supply, you actually increase demand. And that you see that happening in neighborhoods where maybe it's a neighborhood that has some problems and prices are low, but it's in a good location. And so you have sort of pioneers into the neighborhood going in and competing for real estate, and the prices go up. And so developers see that and they say, well, we want to build in this place that is a good location, walkable to jobs, walkable to retail. And so they start building buildings and more people move in. And then those people, you know, that creates enough demand that then new restaurants open and new shops open. And it becomes a very attractive place to live, and that creates more demand. And so the supply induces demand. And so in this circumstance, the market is functioning properly. It's just that supply and demand are sort of racing against each other. And the only market response is really, you know, significant increase in supply. And in these cities, you need to do it in a way that's respectful of
history. Yeah.
Respectful of historical development and the great architecture we have, and try not to displace people.
Well, you can only build up. That's about it.
That's a big response. That's right. Yeah. And cities are very hostile to height, so it's a major challenge.
Yeah. True. Let me just go back to something that's always been I've always been curious about, and that's this bean thing. I mean, I know about the molasses story, but where does this Boston bean thing come from?
Well, beans go back to to Native Americans, and so the Puritan settlers and the Pilgrims borrowed a lot of foods from the Native Americans, corn, beans, squashes are being main ones, which have, I think, the three together provide a complete protein. And so beans are a long-standing staple of the New England diet going back to Native American times. It becomes a staple of the Yankee diet in colonial times because beans could be put on a stove to simmer during the Sabbath, right? So the Puritans, being very observant people, wouldn't cook during the Sabbath, but they could put a pot of beans on the stove and just have it slowly simmer for, you know, all weekend long, basically, and then have a source of good food and good protein. And then the triangular trade, which is not one of our things that we're proud of in New England, unfortunately, which is the slave trade, which was the New England, you know, New England was the center of trade in North America and the world in the 18th and 19th centuries. And so a form of trade develops where New England ships would go to the coast of West Africa and buy kidnapped, you know, humans and bring them to the West Indies and to the American South. But particularly in the West Indies, would trade humans for sugar and molasses, and then bring those north to distilleries in New England, and it would be distilled into rum, and then the rum would be brought to Africa to trade for the slaves. It's the triangular trade was a little bit more complicated and had a little bit more steps, but the basic trade was molasses for rum for slaves, and it circled through. But all the molasses being shipped to New England, you know, not 100% of it was used in to make rum. It wasn't all consumed by the distilleries, and so molasses becomes very common in the you know late colonial period and early 19th century, and so molasses finds its way into a lot of recipes.
Well, and into the streets.
Into the streets, yes.
And Dane is here. He's compiled a book. He's the author of A History of Boston. It has become, by all accounts, the Bible of this city, which is kind of interesting. Beautiful pictures. 800 pages of just about everything. And it's not just the great things. There were some failures involved, Dan, and I know you talk about that as well.
I mean, a lot, yeah. And that was part of trying to understand how the city has swung between periods of success and failure, you know, real conflict with Native Americans in the colonial period, to, you know, the rise of Industrial Revolution, which was a great success but had negative consequences in terms of environmental pollution, and, you know, the industries that we supported. There were slaves in New England in Massachusetts up until 1783, and then the 20th century was a century of a combination of federal, state, and local policies that were highly anti-urban and really tore the city apart between urban renewal, which was tearing down dense neighborhoods to replace them with low-density neighborhoods, and building highways that tore through the heart of the city and displaced thousands of people and thousands of businesses that were built for the purpose of moving people out of the city to the suburbs. We had the way schools were financed, encouraged people to move out to the suburbs, and our tax policies encouraged the purchase of single-family homes in the suburbs over renting in the city. The city was hollowed out, and the way we dealt with it was through these anti-urban policies and retreating to tribalism rather than trying to understand each other. Mm-hmm. So you have really a century of conflict between the Yankees and the Irish immigrants. You know, the Irish need not apply signs, that was a real thing. Hostility between white citizens and black citizens of Boston, you know, with redlining, which was a federal policy. And then we have something called reverse redlining, where federally backed mortgages were only given to blacks who moved into the Jewish neighborhoods of Boston in the 1960s, with really essentially a creation of an urban ghetto. Through school busing, and Whitey Bulger being enabled by the FBI. So lots of things that are we should not be so proud of.
They were not feathers. Not feathers in the
cap. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Right. Tell me about the book. How long did it take you to put this together?
So it was 4 years of writing. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges was I tried to write the book up to the present. But when you're writing to the present, the present luck. Changes every single day.
Good luck.
And so literally every morning I'd get up and I'd read the newspaper, and I was constantly cutting out articles and leaving them out and just continuing to add to the end of, essentially add to the end of the book as I continued to do research on the rest of it. And I said, I need an endpoint. I'm never going to finish this thing if I keep adding to the end. Yeah. And so with Michelle Wu's election in November of 2021 as the first female and first person of color to be elected to Boston. I thought that was a real nice way to end in terms of how much the city has changed. So I end in November of 2021.
Nice. And ended with that kind of note is not a bad way to do it. It shows how progressive the city actually is and has become and kind of always was in a sense, but not...
Well, particularly in contrast to what you just talked about.
Yeah, yeah. That's for sure.
That's right. But the book, you know, because it was sort of continuing to be to progress as I wrote it, you know, it covers recent activities such as, you know, obviously the COVID pandemic, and you know I try to cover a very broad amount of information about the city, such as, you know, I have history of restaurants in Boston, and during the pandemic a lot of the restaurants I was writing about were closing, I have these sections about, you know, these are great ethnic restaurants and high-end restaurants. Yeah. And then I put in parentheses, you know, just closed. Oops, just closed.
And some of them never came. I lost some of my greatest restaurants.
Lost a lot, yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. There was a faux restaurant across the street from the Huntington Theater. I used to live there. Oh, I loved it. No more. Anyway, the book is just, it kind of doesn't have any boundaries, Dan. I mean, it's very well constructed, but it'll take you down every path you want to go through. And you're a native of the Boston area, I understand, right?
Yeah, born in Boston, lived in Brighton as a baby. Mm-hmm. My family moved to Newton in the early 1970s. I grew up in Newton, went to Newton North. Mm-hmm. After college and law school, returned to Boston, lived in Beacon Hill, and then I got married and moved to Needham, which I, you know... as I said, political, you know, the boundaries of a city are really political drawings on a map. You know, and so I've considered Boston to be my home this whole time. So I'm excited to bring this book out about Boston. I do have some events coming up. I'd love to meet people. I have an event on Monday at 6 p.m. at the Cambridge Public Library, an event sponsored by the Harvard Bookstore. Harvard Bookstore is asking people to RSVP so they have a sense of numbers, but it's a free event.
Excellent.
If you go to the Harvard Bookstore website, you can get information about the event at the Cambridge Public Library, and I'll be doing a book talk and probably repeating some of the things I said, you know, today. But there's a lot to talk about in the history of Boston, so I'll have plenty of new things to say as well.
All right. So that's on September 18th. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And is there a website that people can visit?
So just my law firm, www.danetorpy.com, DAINTORPY, has information about where you can buy the book. Okay. But it's available, you know, I hope people buy it in local bookstores because I always like to support bookstores.
Sure.
It is available online for people who find that easier, but I hope people get out to their local bookstores. I talk about the history of bookstores in Boston as well, so they cover just about everything.
Cool.
So go please support local businesses.
Dan, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Congratulations on the book and everything that follows with it. And it's great that you've done this. We appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. It was fun.
Take care. Well, all right, that'll do it for me today. I'll be back again tomorrow with a brand new program, but until that time arrives, I wish you peace.